Welcome to the IF podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation, and joining me in the studio is Jeff Prudhomme.
Thanks for having me here.
And on the line from Madison, Wisconsin, is Melissa Simonson, a public discussion facilitator for the Interactivity Foundation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And today, as part of our podcast, we'll be discussing three topics. We'll be talking about the topic of obesity and public policy. We'll talk about art in developing cities. And finally, we'll also discuss the issue of marriage as an issue of public concern. Let's start with obesity. Michelle Obama, the first lady, has had a sometimes controversial campaign, Let's Move, encouraging young people to get moving and to eat healthy. She's also brokered agreements with private companies such as Walmart to have healthier food in the stores. And some of these efforts have been somewhat controversial because many wonder, what is the role of government in our kitchens? Why are they trying to regulate our waistline? So Jeff, why is this issue an area of concern for the foundation and for the public in general?
Well, I think one of the ways this topic came into our viewpoint was that it's been such a growing area of public concern in terms of issues about public health and overall health of our population and how that correlates to the increase of diabetes, especially in younger people, and then the incidence of heart disease. We're also interested in the way that this topic really intersects with a number of different areas like economics, the access that people might have to different qualities of food depending on their economic class, and the ways different communities have different access to different quality of food. So for us, it's kind of interesting the way this topic, once you start pulling at it, opens up these other dimensions. In fact, we just did a recent project on food and food policy that should be interesting in this respect.
Yeah, Melissa, you recently led some discussions around that, some of the possibilities that were generated by that report. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
Well, first of all, just one thing, just in response to what Jeff was talking about, too, is I think another thing that I've noticed that's so interesting as a public discussion facilitator is how no matter what the topic is that we are discussing, that it often comes down to education as being a really important aspect of that. And I think that with food, it's no different. And I know when I led a discussion, it was, really looking at, how do you deal with this issue and get to the underlying systemic foundation of what's going on. And it almost always comes down to that education piece. So some of the core possibilities that we explored had to do with strengthening the links between the field and factory and community and table, so getting people more involved in the food production and growing their own food in both urban and rural communities. Looking at ways of making agriculture more sustainable, looking at ways of changing the economics of food and farming, supporting independent farmers and farms, so kind of moving away from the large factory farms to supporting the smaller local, community farmers, but also looking at what it is that we're putting in our foods, like what is going into our food, and if our only options are things that are really harming our bodies, is this good for all of us, even if it's less expensive than the other alternative? But the question becomes, is it less expensive? How is this impacting us as human beings? But I think the main thing I saw was people really were looking at, we can't just treat the symptoms of this issue. We really have to look at a whole re-education of what food is about and really shifting the culture around it. So I would think that in many ways, that's what Michelle Obama is trying to do with her program. And I can understand how some people could feel like that's invasive into their own choices.
When I was thinking about this topic yesterday, it brought to mind there was a lengthy Washington City paper article about a kid they called Heavy T, who was morbidly obese. He was 14 years old. And this was in 1997 that this article came out, and the city social workers were going after his mother, actually, and charging her with child abuse. They wanted to remove him from her home, and he was basically on the run. At the time, there wasn't as much discussion around food and food policy, and certainly there wasn't a Let's Move campaign. And it was very controversial actions on the part of the social workers, because it's like, if she wants to allow him to eat the Twinkies, you would think that would be that would be her choice. But it had gotten to the point where he was a danger to himself. And also, if you're making the short-term choice, it's cheaper to eat the Twinkie. But if you're looking at society and the good of everyone, you know, including our health costs, there would be a reason for the social workers to go in there.
That's come up in almost every one of our projects, how to draw this line between private control and public involvement and where things become a matter of public concern. And that's actually been one of the fun things to explore, the different ways to draw that line. Mm-hmm. And you could say that, well, if there's a public interest in keeping that child from having Twinkies, is there also a public concern in making sure there are good food choices, affordable food mm-hmm. choices for all families, so that we don't have these food deserts in our urban areas, for example, so that people could get fresh produce? And that kind of ties in with the point you were making, Melissa, about the policy of encouraging more local food production, including urban agriculture.
You know, one thing that I know came up a lot in my discussion is, you know, how people talk about wanting to have a choice and not wanting to be forced to eat, you know, one thing over another. But the question becomes, is there a choice? Because the stuff that's being, you know, I think of the high fructose corn syrup that's present in nearly all of our food these days, it's like if people need to buy food and trying to buy affordable food and not knowing that there are these things there that can be heightening obesity. And, you know, one of my participants actually talked about how it's a biological problem. It's not just a matter of choice of, you know, choosing the healthy thing or not, that our body chemistry mm-hmm. is processing food differently because of what we're putting into it. And so it's causing us to have cravings for these processed carbs. So, you know, that's where it does kind of come back to this thought of, okay, so at what point do we intervene? Because this could be something that's harming us on a mass scale. And it's no longer just about that individual choice.
In the movie Food Inc., which I saw a couple years ago when it came out, kind of amazing documentary. It looked at how this working class family struggling to pay their bills, struggling to pay their healthcare bills, ate McDonald's on a regular basis because it's cheap. It's right. fast, cheap food. And so, you know, on the one hand, it allowed them to make it to the next paycheck. But then the husband, I think, was a diabetic. And then so they were sort of also trying to afford the medication for the various health problems caused by it. So you see how we are on a slippery slope a little bit to where we get into the business of banning places like McDonald's and Taco Bell. So like, where does the regulation end?
Can I bring up an interesting twist on that? This morning, opening up the Washington Post webpage online, a prominent ad on the sidebar showed a beautiful picture of a head of broccoli. And it was an ad from the Mars Corporation, the candy company. Huh. I didn't click on the link, but on the face of it, it was advocating that people inform themselves about better food choices. Uh-huh. And they're representing themselves as a good corporate citizen, that they're trying to, as a candy company, promote healthy food choices, which I thought was pretty.
Well, they're playing offense, I guess. they don't want yeah. people to come after them.
I know recently there were some soap operas canceled that have been on for, you know, what, 20 mm-hmm. some years. And what I found out was going to replace them are these sort of like health shows, conscious living kind of shows that you're seeing more and more because of the sort of Oprah era. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of lending consumers to be demanding more of this healthy stuff. And so then you have things like these candy companies that are sort of like, hey, just so you know, it almost makes me think it's like we have to look good mm-hmm. to be attractive in the right. current market, which is, I think, interesting evolution that's happening. And of course, we'll have some people that just think that you can't just rely on the market. But then on some levels, you can look at current trends and say, well, you know, we're obviously consumers are starting to demand these things.
It's a generational change. And, you know, that's what the First Lady is sort of getting at. And I wonder, without that big stick and that big bully pulpit, would Walmart have agreed to that deal to have all this food available? You know, because I have friends who work for the health department here in the city, and they're trying to work with, say, food trucks, which are sort of this hip thing, but they're trying to get them into underserved areas, these food deserts, and having them offer fresh food, because without an incentive, there's no reason for them to do it. But the question is also, well, what do you do with arugula? You know, would you, you know what to do with it if you get it?
Right.
You know, you're like, well, what is this? You know, especially kids. They're like, huh? What is this? What am I supposed to do with this? So that's, I think, where the education part comes in that you, that Melissa was just talking about.
Oh, I've had friends who have participated in these farm shares. There's the one in the Madison area that puts out a cookbook for that exact reason. So, you know, you get all these vegetables dropped off at your door, and you get something like kohlrabi, and you're like, what do I do with this? You know, there's the cookbook that gives you a bunch of recipes to be able to use it. So it's cool how there's all these different levels of bringing that education in.
Maybe that's what we need to do, is put out an IF cookbook.
Oh, that would be fun.
All right. So the next topic that we have is the issue of art in developing cities. Can this be an interactive tool for public deliberation? And this is a topic that overlaps with two projects that are ongoing. Jeff Pridham is, this summer, he should be wrapping up a project on shaping our cities and towns. And I just began a project on the future of the arts and society. And so this is something that is kind of like hit the bullseye. And there was recently some coverage of a very interesting art project in the city of New Orleans. In these areas that are still have still not rebounded from Hurricane Katrina, there are many abandoned homes. And somebody had the idea of create this wonderful art installation on the houses themselves. And so it was a community-wide effort. Everyone would add, not like graffiti, but, you know, everyone would sort of add, contribute to the evolution of this art project. And so they turned these buildings that were eyesores into something that's beautiful, but also the buildings were sort of a conversation too.
Right. And that's been a big theme in the Shaping Our Towns and Cities project, the way that art in the public sphere or art in the public space could be a way for communities to have a voice and for people to have a voice, a way to draw people together. So we're not just talking about things like museums or having art galleries, although those have also figured into our discussions, but also just the ability of the people in a community to express themselves, and that there is an interest that people have about expressing themselves artistically. So I think that piece was really interesting, that place in New Orleans, that abandoned house. I think, if I don't remember exactly, but wasn't it people were writing what they would want to do before they die or something
yes,
like that.
Before I die.
Cool.
And there was chalk available there. And so you could just fill in what you wanted to, you know, say on there.
Melissa, are you seeing certain similar movements out there in the Madison area around art and public engagement?
I feel really blessed just having traveled to other cities and realizing, particularly with music, that Madison makes a lot of room for like free live music venues and things. So like the Capitol is sort of the central part of downtown, and there's this pedestrian street attached to it. And so at different times in the summertime, usually on Wednesday evenings, like there'll be like a jazz at five kind of thing, and people can bring their chairs and, you know, their food, and or there's the chamber orchestra plays on Wednesday evenings as well, and people can even bring bottles of wine and sit around the Capitol building on the hill and listen. And so there's these really cool opportunities for free music, and the community that comes out of that, I think, is so profound. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much literature out there that shows that the arts are a huge, important part of our well-being on, you know, emotional, spiritual, even physical, you know, levels. I think this is a great conversation to have, because it seems to be, even in our schools, for example, there's less and less emphasis on it. Like somehow it's a frivolous thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because we enjoy it and it's fun, but it somehow seems like it's not a worthwhile thing, or, you know, it's not a priority.
You know, I was recently speaking to one of the other fellows. There was some complaint on the Hill about the wasteful spending, and, you know, these museums are getting out of control. Why are we adding so many museums, and why are we supporting so many museums? We're in a recession, et cetera, et cetera. You know, what she was saying was that, well, you know, they just spent $1 billion on a sports stadium. You know, the city did in Washington, D.C. Sports are fun. their economic revitalization tools. And everybody seems to understand that. With the arts, for some reason, it's not as widely accepted. So I'm not sure, you know, why that's the case. And then, you know, also, you know, one of the issues that has come up in my panel is that some people believe that the government really shouldn't be involved in supporting or in deciding these issues of who gets support, who gets access, because everything becomes very politicized. You know, one example of that, I think the panelist wasn't speaking about that in particular, but, you know, one example of that was last week at the White House. They had poetry night and they brought in this rapper called Common, who is the flower child of flower child as far as rappers go. You know, Sarah Palin and others raised a lot of questions about certain songs that he had done in the past, and they thought that it was not suitable or appropriate for him to be at the White House. So, you know, it does become a problem sometimes when you're going down that road. Things get politicized.
Yeah. I want to bring up another point about arts in the community that has come up in the Towns and Cities Project, and that kind of goes with this idea of taking care of where you live. And that has to do with like taking care of the way it looks. So it's not just about, it's not just literally about artworks or things like that, but paying attention to the aesthetics of your neighborhood or the aesthetics of your town and city. Mm-hmm. And that taking that care in the way a place looks could be, some of the panelists thought, like a way to express more broadly a concern about where you live that would have a spillover effect on the quality of the community and community life.
Absolutely. And then, you know, again, this is that line that we keep talking about. Where does public begin? Where does private begin? If the government is involved in supporting public art projects and supporting the sort of concerts that Melissa was talking about in Madison, these free concerts, you know, because of the democratic process, they're also accountable to the general public as well, so they can still become politicized.
Well, this makes me even think of, like, with our science report, I mean, I think it becomes, you know, you're sort of talking about if it's funded by the government, the question becomes, is there a way of there not being strings attached? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in the science report, we have one policy that's looking at allowing those who fund science to regulate it. And I think this is sort of a similar thing within the arts community. So, you know, whether it's, you know, certain political parties saying they think this isn't appropriate because it doesn't match their, you know, value system or whatever it might be, there becomes this sort of hinder of the expression of what it could be or, you know, that possibility. I think the question can become, you know, is there a way to create the opportunity, you know, maybe not be in so involved where they're constructing this or making it happen, but that they're not closing out the opportunity for it to happen either.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like not directly intervening, but creating the space and staying out of the way.
Yeah. I'm not sure within Madison. I'm not sure that the city is funding that. I would think it's probably like the space is available. So the city is designed in a way that these things can happen. You know, I can't say for certain, but I'm thinking it's more private groups that are the ones that are organizing music and making that happen.
Then it becomes almost like the Field of Dreams thing. If they build it,
yeah.
If you build it, they will come.
You know, when I think of your project, I would imagine that that's a conversation that, you know, you're having, because it's true. Like if you don't make room for it, if you build your cities in a certain way where that kind of community engagement can't happen, you know, it's like they're just making it a lot more challenging. People might do it, but it's not going to be maybe as large and collective of a process.
And that's come up with both panels in that project, that a really strong theme that people need places to gather, like you were describing, for coming together for concerts. And with both panels, I think they would say, you know, we need some place for people to come together for artistic reasons. But they've also just said people need a place to gather. People need places for social interactions. They need squares. They need pedestrian zones. They need, you know, plazas or whatnot. And we need to encourage those spaces and then let people do their thing.
From the arts perspective, the only problem with that is that, you know, art is often, the purpose is to provoke and to
trouble us.
It's supposed to trouble us.
Yeah.
It's like when art is at its best, it's very disruptive. There are some tensions because there should be public accountability. If it's a public space available to everyone, it shouldn't be anything is perceived to be harmful to certain people. And, you know, so there is, you know, that it's in direct conflict with the democratic process. And so it's not that it's impossible to do, but navigating it can be difficult.
Mm-hmm. One place you'll find that discussed is in the report that will come out about shaping our towns and cities. And I'll be wrapping up those discussions this summer. So hopefully by this winter, we'll have a report for citizen discussions on that topic. And then Natalie, you're working on the project on the future of arts.
We're about a year away from that, but we're also in the process of doing test discussions, like Melissa had mentioned, that she's doing around the food project. And then, you know, for the larger conceptual questions around areas of privacy, there is a privacy report that's available on our website, interactivityfoundation.org, as well as property, I would think would be another area that intersects with that, some of these questions that we're discussing. So if you're interested in checking out the report or possibly organizing a group to discuss these issues, email ifpodcast@gmail.com, or you can contact us through the website as well. So our next topic is marriage and fidelity as an area of concern. Now, IF is also in the process of doing a project on the future of the family, but recent events have really forced this issue to the forefront. Former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has admitted to having a child with his maid who lived in the home with him and his family. And infidelity was topic A in the impeachment proceedings against former President Bill Clinton. Right now, Mitch Daniels, who's an Indiana governor, is considered a potential GOP candidate for president. And his issues that he's had with his marriage has been fair game on many very respected public outlets such as NPR, as is Newt Gingrich and the marriages that he's had before. And so I think the question for us is private marriage a fair game for public interest and public policy? How does it help the debate? Does it have a place in the public policy debate?
I recently, or within the last year, I read a book, Elizabeth Gilbert, who's actually the author of the book Eat, Pray, Love, mm-hmm. she put out a sequel called Committed, mm-hmm. and it was her journey toward trying to decide if she wanted to do the marriage thing again. She'd been previously married, and so she studied cross-culturally as well as historically the whole concept of marriage. And it was interesting how she kind of argued and looked at marriage as being a threat to the larger institution or threat to the state, that if once you have two people coming together and creating their sort of their own values together and their own system of union, that it become potentially subversive. And so throughout history, it sort of evolved based on, you can look at this evolution as to, oh no, now we have this to contend with. It just becomes part of the government process. It's like, okay, if you want to do this, we got to make sure we're in control or we're in charge of this, so that you can't, you know, collectively organize or, you know, I don't know the full kind of complete argument against it, but I found it kind of interesting mm-hmm. that in her argument, it was saying that marriage is never really for the couple that are actually engaging in it. And it's all about the state as a whole. Hmm. So that sort of is just an interesting thing to put out there in terms of, you know, public versus private. And is it private once you've legitimized it in that official way?
That really intersects in an interesting way with some of the possibilities that came up in the family discussions we did. And those will be coming out, I guess, in another few months in terms of a discussion report about the future of the family. But one of the possibilities that came out of that project was thinking about the family as really something beyond the state or more primary than the state and something to which the state should defer. And so it was really saying, like, if you look at this conflict or potential conflict of the state and the family should take precedence and the state should defer to what the family wants to do. And basically, in other words, create a protected space where people can, according to their own traditions or according to their belief systems or their religion, they can decide to, you know, govern their marriages and their family relationships as they see fit within that cultural tradition, and just leave the state out of it.
Which is great until, you know, there's Waco or...
Right.
Well, there are those cases in the LDS church where there are some branches that encourage polygamy.
Right.
I can't think of the guy's name who's been arrested in that who was charged with not just polygamy, mm-hmm. but because there are underage girls that are being brought into these marriages. So then questions come up in terms of when is there something that becomes a state interest, like if children are being harmed.
Typically, it's children. I mean, that seems to be the idea that everyone can understand, you know, when you don't choose to come into this world. And the idea is that the government has a responsibility to make sure that you have basic human rights and living conditions that are suitable for our, you know, so-called first world lifestyle that we have. And so that actually, there's yet another IF project that relates to that that's coming down the pike, which is the future of childhood. And because, you know, our notions of childhood, our notions of the family, it's not just this nuclear family. And in fact, I think the latest statistics showed that the nuclear families, they're outnumbered, you know, by women-led households in this country. We've crossed over that line, but we're still legislating as if that is the norm. It actually isn't the norm anymore. So how do we
catch our policy models to the norms that we're actually living by?
Right. Or, you know, because I think that sometimes public policy is aspirational. It's people want to enforce certain norms and certain ways that people should live. You know, you're supposed to have a man, a woman, and a child, and, you know, you're supposed to have 2.5 kids or whatever. And so because a certain amount of society has bought into what this notion of what the family is supposed to look like, all of our policies are sort of legislated toward that. And so there's a lot of fear among some segments of the population that, well, what happens if that's not the model anymore? What will happen to our society if that's not what everyone is trying to strive for?
Right.
Well, and that was one interesting thing that I know came up in that book that I was reading, is it's sort of like, I think she was sort of talking about how there's kind of a tipping point, how eventually if enough people just start doing it, I mean, I think that, you know, we look at the current issues with the concept of marriage between one man and one woman versus, you know, the potential for homosexual marriage or, you know, any of that. And you know, we're seeing more and more states that are agreeing to civil unions and, you know, sort of shifting this. And sort of the question is that, does it just reach this tipping point where enough people demand it that the state or, you know, the government has to accommodate in order, whether you could see it from a control standpoint or, you know, either way, it's sort of this way in which maybe we work together, you know, so that it's not, you know, Waco happening all over the place, you know, or versus, and it's also, you know, not just this total government control over our families and our society either.
It's kind of interesting in that respect. We had two possibilities in the family discussion that came up in kind of very divergent directions. One saying, no, what we absolutely need to do is protect the kind of traditional notion of a heterosexual union at the basis of a nuclear family. And so the policy was totally built around encouraging and supporting that model of family and basically excluding every other model. And even to the extent that's not often talked about in terms of not just allowing only this kind of marriage, but making it very difficult to get out of that kind of marriage. Mm-hmm. People don't often think about that, but, you know, I think some states have this notion of covenant marriage, that if you enter into that level of marriage commitment, then there are additional obstacles to ever dissolving those unions. Mm-hmm. But then a totally different approach also came up in the project, and that was this notion of establishing essentially charter families. So you can come together and charter whatever kind of family you want. If you want it to be a gay marriage, that's fine. And we talked about families as not just about erotic unions or love unions in that romantic sense, but also you could have a family unit that just wants to be recognized. And let's say, you know, these are two sisters who have always lived together and they want to have all the benefits that families typically enjoy as a household and want to make sure that they have that kind of state protections. You know, we're not talking about incest, right? There's nothing sexual about this. It's just strictly protecting this role of the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or grandparents who are raising their kids, which you might not see yourself in that role and you might not expect to be in that role. But the fact is that many people are in that situation. And, you know, I think that part of the resistance for changing, you know, as Melissa said, you know, people demanding, okay, the government should recognize these alternatives to the traditional nuclear heterosexual union, is that so many people who don't have the 2.5 kids and the, you know, the marriage, it's like an aspiration. They still aspire to be that. You know, I think that attitudes haven't totally caught up with what the reality is. And, you know, there are many people who believe that we should be holding the line and that this should be the way that it is.
I wanted to bring up just a totally different strand of thinking of politics and the family that that came up in, I think, an unexpected way in the family discussions. And that was the role of powerful families in our political communities. And I think all of us at any level of community, we probably know within our hometowns, families that were more powerful than other families, and their kids went on to inherit that power. But also, if you think of at the national level, if you look at Congress, so many of the people who are in Congress now came from political families, in some cases, almost directly inheriting the office where maybe a father passed away and then the son steps in to fulfill the rest of his term or is subsequently elected to take over that seat. Interestingly, in the project, one of the ways this came up was thinking about how some families, not all families, but some families could actually be an obstacle to democracy. And so what you would want to do is actually limit the abilities of families to accrue inherited power like that and make sure that the rest of us have more of a chance.
Watching the royal wedding, you know, you know, this is something that makes America different, is that we don't think that we have royalty and we don't have these. But if you really think about, as Jeff was saying, we do. I mean, many people did inherit their political power is concentrated and on the national level and also on the local level as well. So maybe America has arrived in that sense, is that we've got our own homegrown royalty.
Exactly. I mean, there are so many political families that you realize the offspring of those families have opportunities that have nothing to do with their merits or anything that they have specifically accomplished beyond having the good intelligence to choose the right parents.
Well, and all of these things seem to lead to the underlying question of, you know, what is the family for? What is marriage for? Mm-hmm. Who is it serving? You know, all of that. And I think it's interesting how they all point to different, you know, the policy possibilities you were discussing, Jeff. They kind of point to different answers to that question.
You know, it could be potentially a very vital public interest what Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing in his home and in his family. You know, I think is one of the findings that we're finding here.
If even just to get us having the conversation.
I think the Schwarzenegger case brings up another interesting twist where you think of people's family lives and their marital lives and the question of where those private concerns become public ones. With some people, they'll say, well, it's reflective of the character of this person. And if you're choosing someone for an elected office, you want to pay attention to their personal characteristics. There's other people who would say, well, how they behave in their family is totally irrelevant in terms of the kind of public judgments they might make or the policy positions they might put through. But another aspect of this comes up in the Schwarzenegger case, where if I understand the situation correctly, this was a woman in his employment in a, you know, a subordinate role. And I would think it's more appropriately seen as sexual harassment, what he was engaged in. And then that's different from kind of a character judgment. That becomes a legal issue.
Well, and then, I mean, even when he was running for governor, I remember I think the LA Times did a whole expose where they looked at all these women who said that Arnold Schwarzenegger had harassed them, had groping, was just, his behavior was completely inappropriate. And then we had that debate at that point about, well, is this fair game? Is this worth discussing? Is this, you know, is this something that voters should consider in whether this man becomes elected governor? And I don't know that question has been totally settled yet, but, you know, it did seem like there was some fire where that smoke was in any case.
If these questions and issues about family lead you to think about the future of childhood in our society, I should point out, we're talking about this in late May of 2011. We've got a project right now on the future of childhood that's recruiting. And so if you're in the greater DC area and are interested, drop us a line. I'm sure you know, the director of that project, Sue Lee, would be glad to talk to you about it.
Absolutely. And you can contact us at ifpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback. Love to hear that you're listening. Love to hear what your thoughts are about any of the ideas that we've discussed here. This has been the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Melissa, have a wonderful day out there in Madison.
Thank you.
And thanks to Abdul Rufus for engineering and podcast production.